Bibles, we are going to be looking at the scriptures. If you could reach in front of you, there's one in the pew. If you could use your smartphones, whatever translation or copy of the scriptures that you own. I have only been to the emergency room a couple times in my life. Had a good sister in our church go to the emergency room this week, and I know we have several doctors and even an emergency room worker who is at our church, but whenever I go to the ER, it's always memorable. Perhaps you would say the same. A few weeks after our daughter came home from the hospital, our little girl, we're not sure what she had, but she came down with some type of illness that, you know, one of those at midnight, she's still not crying, she's an infant, and at midnight, she's still not asleep, inconsolable, and we had that moment of, oh no, here we go, let's go to the emergency room. And I'm sure you know how ERs are, but there's this feeling of, am I ever going to get treated? Which is what we just prayed for. It's what we just thanked the Lord for, that he took Joanne Clancy through this week. I know that feeling as a dad. It's sort of this helplessness, and an ER is very crazy because there are people being wheeled all around. There are doctors going from one room to the other. There are nurses that are just in charge of something called triage. And triage, as far as I know, is who gets treated when, because everybody's ill. So I stood there in a treatment room waiting, and it might have been 2 hours, 3 hours, and as far as I was concerned, my little girl was dying. And as a parent, you start to get agitated, and you're like, okay, just don't say anything. Stand by and wait. Someone's going to come. Maybe somebody's going to come. Am I ever going to get treated? And that starts to churn through your mind, such that at one point, I actually even stuck my arm out in the hallway, grabbed someone and said, could we please get some help, or how long do we have to wait? And the answer is, no, sir, we always treat the sickest people first, so just hang on. We'll get there. Hang tight. And it was a night of ambulances, so we were like at the bottom of the triage pole, I guess. So hang tight. It's one of the times in my life where I would say I remember feeling helpless, perhaps feeling anxious. Kind of as you look at the world, as you look at life, you realize you're not really in control of as much as you thought you were or as much as you'd like to think you are. It's exactly what our passage is about this morning. It's what we're going to look at. Last week, we looked at a single verse from the Old Testament, and I thought our time was very rich in the scriptures last week. And there has been, it's rare that this happens to me, but there's been so much kind of feedback from that as we've discussed anxiety and as we've looked at fear. There's been so much feedback from that before we begin our new series, which happens to be in the book of James, we're beginning that next week. And it's ready to go, and we could have started this week, but on this Labor Day weekend, we're going to pause this morning and I think kind of persist or continue in where we left off last week. We're doing the same exact sermon last week, except in narrative form, because there is a passage in the Bible to be what I consider to be, it's disturbing. It's the closest picture in the scriptures about Jesus in an emergency room. And with what went down in our church, I sort of couldn't help myself. As we thought about hospitals and ERs and the number of medical care workers that we have, I think this passage, it's in Mark chapter 5, would you open there, is the closest thing we have in the scriptures to an ER situation, to a fear, anxiety-producing scenario, except it's not in proverb poetry form, it is in historical narrative form. We're going to follow Jesus into the ER and see what it means to follow him. Last week, we talked about fear and the God of peace. This week, you'll see at the top of your outlines, in your bulletins, faith and the God of peace. I'll begin reading at verse 21. Hear the word of the Lord. It says this, and when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. And then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name. And seeing him, Jairus fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, my little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live. And he went with him. And a great crowd followed him, and thronged about him. And there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, if I touch even his garments, I'll be made well. And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned around in the crowd and said, who touched my garments? And the disciples said to him, you see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, who touched me? And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. While Jesus was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further? But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, do not fear, only believe. And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. And they came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue. And Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping. And they laughed at him. But he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, Talitha kumi, which means, little girl, I say to you, arise. And immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. And he strictly charged them that no one should know this, and he told them to give her something to eat. This is God's word. Jesus, in this passage, is, you could say, he's at a high point in his ministry or at the popularity peak of his ministry. Crowds regularly gather. You see in the passage, people frequently flock to him. I know we're picking up in the middle of a book, which is unusual for us at West Valley, but if you were to read the first four chapters and the first half of chapter five, Jesus is on his way to help a little girl who is sick, largely because Jesus in the book of Mark has exercised authority over people. He has renamed people. Jesus has exercised authority over the forces of nature. Jesus has exercised authority over the forces of evil. That has happened in the book of Mark. So here, now, he's on his way to help a little girl who is sick, which is sort of a normal part of his ministry. But I believe Mark introduces us to this story because, big picture, what happened in all the verses that we just read, Jesus, on his way, help little girl, interrupted by another person who is needy. You see how the emergency room feel is echoed here. It's a moment of triage in the ministry of Jesus. If you imagine this to be similar to an emergency room then, if that's what this is like, if this is Jesus doing triage, Jesus does something which is incredibly strange. Did you notice? Jesus breaks every emergency room rule in that he does not treat the sickest person first. Did you see that? That's why this is a disturbing passage. It's beyond weird. A little girl is dying, and a bleeding woman, well, it's a chronic condition. So, and everybody knows that whenever you have somebody who is acutely ill and somebody who is chronically ill, physicians, back me up here, you generally treat the person who is closest to dying first, called triage. But when we look at our Savior, and surprisingly enough, when we look at Jesus, you can almost put yourself in the story a little bit. Jesus, he's not rushed. He's not wringing his hands and he's not running about. He's not, who do I go to now? He doesn't actually seem frantic much at all. You could even say that in what we just read, Jesus does not seem to think this is an emergency whatsoever. Any modern-day doctor reading this passage would say, this isn't just weird, Jesus. This is medical malpractice, Jesus. And this is that's part of what I think makes this an amazing story for us to consider this morning, where as a church we've had people in the ER, where as a church we've had a lot of health things going on, where as a church we happen to be considering fear, and people have said, can we just hear a little bit more about that? What does it mean to follow a Jesus that's not rushed, that seems to be in medical malpractice? Well, the answer is it means having faith in him. So what does it mean to follow Jesus, have faith in Jesus? You'll see there are three. You can write in if you like. This passage seems to indicate that real faith is about being desperate. I hate that point. Real faith seems, in this story, to be about being desperate. Verse 22, if you look back to the beginning, it says, then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, this guy Jairus, falls at Jesus' feet and implored him, saying, my little girl is at the point of death. Come, lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live. Okay, the first person who shows up in Mark 5, second half, first person in our story is a man whose name is Jairus. And if you put the microscope over Jairus just for a second, if I just were to tell you the story of Jairus, he's a synagogue ruler. It says that right in the beginning of our passage, which means, when you imagine Jairus, you should think he's the equivalent of a church elder, perhaps. He's probably in charge of worship, is my guess. He would oversee the teaching in the synagogue, we could speculate. But the bottom line is, Jairus is a big shot because it's harder to get more highly esteemed in a community than a synagogue ruler. So use your imagination. Jairus, man, in control, confident, respected. That's who he is. But did you notice what the in-control, confident, respected man does? When suffering comes knocking on his door, he works his way through the crowd, and the passage says he finds Jesus, and he falls at Jesus' feet. Very surprising detail. A part of what Mark is saying is this guy who's used to everything being done the way he says, all of a sudden, it's difficulty has hit, anxiety has hit, and he suddenly forgets what people think about him. And very quickly, he is desperate and he is humble. And you go, that's always what it means to meet Jesus. That's the prerequisite for meeting Jesus. That's how it happens in the Gospels. That's character number one. But then after a while, there's interruption. Here comes triage. Another person shows up. It's a woman. Did you notice what her name was? Her name is Bleeding Woman. That's all we got. Verse 25, it says, and a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years. So I believe Mark's cluing us in. She doesn't have a name. At least she's unnamed in the story, because why bother give her a name? Herself and her identity is completely tied in to the fact that she has a bleeding problem. The text says she has had a bleeding problem for 12 years, which creepily enough is the same age as the little girl. So she has had a bleeding problem for 12 years. And then the text says, here it is, she suffered much under many physicians. Do you see that? I believe it's in verse 25. She suffered much under many physicians. And you should consider that for a minute and think of the culture this woman would have grown up in. Can I just tell you the story of the woman, perhaps? We can speculate based on things that are written what that verse means, suffered much under many physicians. There is a huge industry in ancient Israel to help treat people who have wacky, uncurable diseases. Can I read you some of the cures? Let me just shine a spotlight on verse 25. Suffered much under many physicians. Listen to perhaps what that verse might be saying. A woman who has a bleeding problem. Ready? Here's sort of a medical journal of ancient Israel. Set the woman in a place where two roads meet. Let her hold a cup of wine in her right hand and hop on one foot. Let someone come behind her and suddenly say, arise from your flow of blood. If this fails, try it again for 18 days in a row. I mentioned she's paying physicians for this. If these do no good, let her dig 7 ditches. Let her burn some cuttings of vine. Let her take in her hand, a cup of wine. I don't know what's with the wine, but Let her move away from each ditch, undress, and scream out, arise, flow of blood, be away from me. Okay. Do you understand what this woman's life is like? She is paying for this for 12 years. So you need to ask yourself, what do an esteemed ruler and a bleeding woman have in common? The answer is, I think, both of them have run out of ideas on how to fix their lives. That's what they have in common. That's why Mark juxtaposes these two stories. That's probably why this moment stood out in his mind, or Peter's mind, as he interviewed Peter. The people in this story, if you were to come up with a theme, they are sad. If you were to come up with a theme, they've tried a lot of stuff, and they are completely frustrated with themselves. You know, they've done this, they've tried this, they've said, I know what'll help me. I know what'll help me feel not sad anymore. I know what'll help my desperate... I will go to the doctor. I'll go down to the best doctor. I'll travel the country. I'll get a promotion at work. They've tried everything, and they are frustrated with themselves. Am I talking to anybody else who is here? If so, if that describes you, if you can easily look at this story and say, I know what that's like, then realize, friend, you should be encouraged. Because those are the people in the Bible who find God. Those are the people in the Bible who Jesus draws near to, and those are the people throughout the scriptures that it said, God draws near to the brokenhearted. He draws near to the broken, I don't know what I'm going to do moments that we go through in life. I was in college, finishing college when 9/11 happened in our country. Yeah, and you know, we can all tell stories of where we were. I was an RA in college when 9/11 happened. And there was a kind of common refrain that I heard as I tried to counsel and help freshmen come to grips with a terrorist attack on home soil. Because you know what everybody says when something like that happens? You know what people say when they look at TV and they see what happens in the Middle East? Here's a phrase that comes out of people's mouth. Oh my God. Atheists say that. Agnostic people say that. Christian people say that. Doesn't matter who you are. Everybody says, oh my God. Everybody gets particularly spiritual. Some people say, oh my God, in a hard way. In an angry way. And some people say, oh my God, in a soft, broken way. I think that's what Mark is saying, is that there's something about desperation that can either harden you or it can melt you. There's the old saying, right? You've heard Christians say, the same sun that melts wax hardens clay. And this is a story of two people who, for whatever reason, the Spirit worked in their hearts so that they were softened. They took a step toward, not a step away. That's what desperation does in your life. That's a theology of hurt and pain. So by way of application, I didn't put this on your outline, but each of these will have one. By way of application, here's my encouragement to you. Friends, do not waste those moments of desperation and anxiety. Don't waste it. Don't waste your fear. Don't waste your desperation. Don't waste it, because our culture says if you are out of ideas, that's bad. Being in control, good. So avoid terrible things. Avoid that feeling at all costs. Have a nest egg. Save enough money, which is why when suffering hits, many of us have no idea what to do with it, myself included. The Bible would say, look at this man and woman. Look at who Jesus hangs out with. Brokenness is an opportunity to draw near to God. Real faith is about being desperate. Real faith is about being desperate. Number two, you see it written there. We also seem to see that real faith is about resting on Jesus. Let me explain what I mean by that. Verse 27. There's another amazing thing. It's like story time this morning. Verse 27, she had heard reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, if I touch even his garments, I'll be made well. And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" Okay, now skip to verse 34. Look at what Jesus says. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." Realize there are not many places in the Bible where Jesus applauds people's faith. You could probably count on one hand when that happens. He doesn't usually say, "Great job, well done." He usually reprimands people. But Jesus applauds the woman's faith here. And I would suggest that this bleeding, nameless bleeding woman holds a special place of honor in the Bible because she has faith in Christ, and Jesus says, "That's what I'm talking about." Do you see that? There's a commendation in verse 34. "Your faith has made you well." Great faith. Here it is. And so because Jesus holds her up as an example of faith, okay, yeah, she was desperate. But what did the woman actually just do? What about her made her so special? He doesn't commend Jairus, he commends the woman. And the answer is, well, the woman, I mean, the narrative just says she touches his garment. That's great faith. It's a little strange, can we admit? And it seems a little superstitious. It's not like the woman came up behind Jesus and said, "Jesus, I believe you're the Son of God. I believe in God the Father, maker of heaven and earth." She didn't recite the Apostles' Creed. She didn't say something that reflected a lot of knowledge or a lot of faith. "I believe in God the Father, maker of heaven and earth." There's none of that. She just kind of touches his clothes. And it seems superstitious. And the question comes up, why does Jesus say, "That's what I'm talking about"? And the answer, I think, is in verse 30. Because Jesus felt that power had gone out from him. The Greek word used there is Jesus felt that dynamos had happened. It's where we get the word dynamite. Jesus felt that power had gone out from him. And Mark is saying, I think, Jesus is actually the thing that is powerful in this story. Great faith, being a Christian, navigating fear, when you are desperate, it doesn't mean you actually have to be a giant of your faith. It doesn't mean you have to have creeds and councils and memorize. It doesn't mean having powerful faith. Jesus is saying, "Well done, woman. You have a faith in the one who is powerful. You know who dynamos is. You know what this is like. It's a kind of a common sense thing. It's more important what you have faith in than how much faith you have. Everyone knows this. I learned this on a backpacking trip. Students, calm down. You've heard this story before. I actually went on a 15-mile backpacking trip once, and I have no idea what I'm doing when I go. Don't go into the wild with Dave, okay? Because I'm that guy, and I did once, and we actually got to a point backpacking at the Pennsylvania Grand Canyon where my friend, who's the expert backpacker, I'm the idiot newbie, says, "I think we should go this way." Says, "You see that rock over there? I think that's the pathway we want." And I go, "I don't know what we're talking about." And I'm kind of unclear about how to do this backpacking thing. But he says, "Oh yeah, we should set up that way, walk that way." Now imagine if this didn't happen. My friend, expert backpacker, says, "I'm going to step out and we're going to launch over there and I'm going to stand on that rock and go on that trail even though there's a precipice." And let's say he steps out, Mr. Confident, Mr. Faith-filled person, onto that rock, onto that walkway, and the rock breaks and he falls into a trench. And I stand there going, "That didn't work out. I think we should go this way." And I step over here. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't have a lot of faith. I stand on that rock, but guess what? I'm fine. Who's alive? Not the person who believed with all his heart. It's always the person who believes in the right rock. And that's what Jesus is saying. That's what Mark is pointing to. The right rock, the right person, the dynamos, his name is Jesus. So if you're here and you feel like, I don't have a lot of faith. I have small faith, and I am afraid. This is why the Bible's solution to fearfulness, the answer is fear God. Consider the object of your faith. Study the God of the universe. Let your mind dwell on him and his glory. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Jesus is the one who is powerful. He's in human skin right now. And what this woman knows is, if I just get close to that man, that's where power is. Who is this Jesus? Can I tell you about him? And as you listen to this, perhaps you sense fear squashed in your life. Isaiah says it this way, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were the seraphim. They had six wings. With two, they covered their faces. With two, they covered their feet. And with two, he flew. And one called to the other and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory, and the foundations of the thresholds shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. That's who Jesus is. That's the God of glory. Psalm 115 says, Not to us, O Lord, not to us, but to your name give glory for the sake of your steadfast love and your faithfulness. Why do the nations say, Where is their God? Psalmist says, Our God is in the heavens, and he does what he pleases. That's this Jesus. That's the object of your faith. Romans 11 says it this way. Oh, the depths of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and how inscrutable his ways. For who has known the mind of the Lord? Or who has been his counselor? Or who has given a gift to him that he might be repaid? For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be glory forever. Amen. And here's the great error of our culture, which this passage corrects. The great error of our culture is you feel afraid, and what we're inclined to do is to say, how can I fix me? God, would you help me? In other words, our starting point is ourselves. And we say, let's think about us, let's think about our weeks, let's think about me, and let's go to the Bible and figure out how it diagnoses me and where I see me in there. And the Bible reverses that and says, I understand that you want to be healed. I understand that you have anxiety and there's difficulty, but don't start with yourself. Be transfixed with the glory of God. Consider the object, the person who is authoring these words. His name is Jesus, and power has gone out from him. That's what the woman knows. And the more you fear God, the more you consider it a privilege, I'll just touch the hem of his garments, because who is this man that the wind and the waves obey him? That's great faith. That's great faith. It means being caught up in the fear of the Lord. Understanding that Jesus is the one who upholds all things and take a step toward him. Crazy as it seems, come up with a plan, take a step towards pursuing him. Real faith is resting and trusting, calling on, believing in Jesus. Real faith is about being desperate. Real faith is about resting on Jesus. One more, with which we'll close. Real faith, the result after this, is that real faith defeats our fear. That's your last, number three on your sheets. Real faith defeats our greatest fears. Verse 35, look at how this passage ends. It says, while Jesus was still speaking, because he's dealing with a bleeding woman, there came from the ruler's house some who said, your daughter is dead, why trouble the teacher anymore? But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, do not fear, only believe. And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John. And they came to the house, and Jesus saw the commotion, right? People are wailing and weeping loudly. Can you imagine being Jairus in this story? I mean, Jairus got to Jesus first. Jairus says, Jesus, can you help me? And he's desperate. He has faith. Jesus is going with him. Jesus said, yes. And can you imagine being there? I have a daughter. It's back to the emergency room. Could somebody help me, please? And he's interrupted by this bleeding woman. You know, the passage actually has this little detail that says in verse 33, the bleeding woman fell down and told him the whole truth. Do you see that detail? That means a lot of time passes between verse 33 and verse 34. Jairus must have been standing there next to Jesus, listening to the bleeding woman go on and on and on about why she touched him. And then I was Then it was 5 years ago, and I thought that would help. And then they made me stand in the ditch with the wine thing. And Jesus is listening patiently. And if I were Jairus, I would say, Jesus, the woman has waited 12 years. She can wait another 12 hours. Come with me. We don't see that. And Jesus doesn't let that happen. As a matter of fact, Jesus lets worst case scenario happen to Jairus. He permits it, and his little girl dies. What? Very similar to the death of Lazarus. You read that account in the book of John. Verse 25 is a heartbreaking verse. Verse 35 is a heartbreaking verse. Your daughter's dead. Means just forget about it now, Jesus. Thanks, you took too long. And you could have accusations like, Jesus, this is so unfair. God, what are you doing with my life? Jesus, if you're so good, why do you let bad things happen? What's wrong with you, God? Isn't it my time, right? And then you get to verse 39, which says, and when he entered the house, he said to them, what's with the commotion? In other words, you could say, what are you complaining about? The child is not dead, but asleep. And they laughed at him, understandable. And he put them all outside, took the child's father and mother, those who were with him, and went in where the child was, taking her by the hand. He said to her, Talitha kumi, which means, little girl, I say to you, arise. And immediately the little girl got up and began walking. In the book of Mark, like I said, Jesus has gone up against sickness. Jesus has gone up against demons. Jesus has gone up against oppositions. Jesus has gone up against a storm, forces of nature. This is the first time in this gospel Jesus is staring at death. And let me tell you, I think for people who struggle with fear, if work is anxiety producing, or right now you have a list of things that you're concerned about in life, it's worth asking the question, how does Jesus handle worst case scenario? If you look at the passage and if someone were to ask you that, how does Jesus interact with your worst nightmares coming true? Death has happened, which is final. They don't even have a category for rising from the dead. And here's how Jesus handles it. He does not say, everybody stand back now, here's the big one. He doesn't roll up his sleeves. There's no incantation. Here we go. It says the way Jesus handles it is, Mark tells us the words he used. He says, Talitha kumi. And then he gives the translations, which means little girl, stands up. Little girl, get up. Talitha kumi, you need to realize what that is saying in Aramaic. If I were to translate the Bible, and you're glad I don't, but if I were, Talitha kumi, another way to say that is kind of the way I wake up my daughters in the morning. It's an endearing, best translation might be, upsie daisies, darling. That's Talitha kum. That's power. That's how Jesus interacts with your worst nightmare, with your greatest fear coming true. So, brothers and sisters, I know this is an unusual detour from our usual text and passage that we preach through at our church, but it's worth asking. My friends, what kind of worst-case scenarios race through your minds? What kind of heartbreak have you imagined that might happen? Maybe it hasn't happened. Or what kind of, oh no, has happened that you feel like cannot be reversed? And I want to tell you, being a disciple of Jesus, following this man does not mean you are free from bad things happening. Or from even your darkest what if it, from that happened. It doesn't mean that won't happen. But following this man means knowing and trusting that death to Jesus is only as scary as a good night's sleep. Death to Jesus, he treats it by saying, upsie daisy. Who is this guy? Well, one thing's for sure, that's what it means to follow him. My friends, Is there malpractice in your life? You know what I mean by that? Have you, in the quiet of your hearts, said to God, God, what gives? I am following you. You're coming with me to help me. Life is in shambles. I know many of you may fit that description as I've talked to you. Verse 36 is a great place to land. As we end this two-week deviation talking about fear, Jesus said, do not fear, but believe. Which means the more you increase your sense of delight and trust in Jesus, the less fear has a grip on your life. Do not fear, only believe. Basically, he's saying, Jairus. You might be saying to us, Jairuses, whatever the plural of that is, that might be Jairi. Do you trust me? I am the God who can raise the dead.